in that place were coming from where I was coming from. And I think that goes back to war. I think that goes back to colonialism. I think that goes back to a lot of things. But I think that's really big for white students just romanticizing everything and not being able to see the reality of the situation in which they are in, that they are privileged, that they are, that it is, like, not real to them in a certain sense. It's really damaging to the people, I think, that they're interacting with.
I wonder, do you think all foreign study experiences that, I'm not asking this tendentiously, I'm trying to hold in, do you think most white students who engage in foreign study have experiences of that kind? And if they're richer, more productive experiences, what leads students to be able to have those? What's the distinction? What would be better than what you described? Is there a way to make it better? Should people not go if they're white? See what I'm trying to understand?
I don't have like a judgment in terms of what other people should do. I know that like I had a very rich experience. Like I definitely experienced a lot. And like I think I learned a lot. But I would think that before I would tell anyone else who was thinking about doing such a thing to really like go take some like, I mean, go think about like anti-racism, go look at like the history of like colonialism, go look at like the history of like intervention, US intervention, go think about like what, how much they don't know anything about where they're going. And how much everyone's gonna think that they know something when they, even when they go into a place, people will look up, will be like, oh, you know, you're white, you're rich, you must know something. And how untrue that is. And so that is like, just talked, I mean, I wish there was more of a, like a group of people or an office or whatever at Hampshire that could be like, okay, you're going abroad, like here's like a, you know, a book or a pamphlet or like, you know, think about the fact that you're, you know, 19 years old, you have no idea about what, like where you're going. And like, that's okay, but don't assume that you do, because people will assume that you do, and you can really hurt people like that.
Can I ask which program you went on?
I mean, I don't think that's really important.
Okay, well, the reason was it, I don't need no specific, but was it a Hampshire program or was it a non-Hampshire program?
It was through Hampshire.
Hampshire. Let me just.
I think it was a very good program. I think it has more to do with like being a white American than it does than necessarily going abroad. Like then, you know what I mean? I think like as white Americans, you are given like so much, like maybe not anymore, but at one point there was like so much like regard and like respect in areas because.
Well, in support of what you're saying, I don't know where you learned it. But your self-reflection on the experience seems to be totally appropriate. I don't know how you develop that level of self-reflection if you don't, as Mike was suggesting, go through the experience. The preparation for it is you're arguing for or urging to do. I think it's very appropriate that preparing students for going into anybody's, into another culture, how you do it is crucial and very important. Though in the end, never really sticks until after you've been to that culture and come back and begun to reflect on both where you failed and where you succeeded. The self-reflection process—the self-reflection process—is what's absolutely crucial.
Yeah, but I don't think that the process is necessary. Like that needs to continue in order just to self-reflect. I think that's really—I think that's like really just like just to say that is really arrogant because it's like, oh, so I can just for my own self-reflection, I'll go like. Mess with some other people's stuff. Like that's not, to me, that's really not what, how it should be. There should be other options. I think there are other options.
I was gonna say that you mentioned something about how like you know, I've also been on an exchange, and how you go to a place and they see you, you're like this white person, and they come up to you and they think that you have, you know, an answer or that you're a specific way. Basically, the same kind of assumptions that you're probably gonna have about this culture. And in some ways, I think that's why study abroad programs can be very good, and that it's more about the way that you go into them, because with the way the media portrays human beings in general, whatever kind of human being you are, and the way that it, you know, Western media touches so many different countries, there's something really, I don't know what the right word for it is, there's something really important, I think, about someone, about people making contacts where those people will come up to you and realize eventually, because you'll get to know them as human beings and not as someone of this specific culture, they'll realize that you are also just a human being and not someone that is white, someone that is of that something else, and that you can make that connection and realize that you're not just going to, like, you know, study or observe or whatever, like, in this romantic way, that it can really just be, like, living, you know? You're just living with these, with people, human beings, and you make connections that aren't on, you know, this racially, culturally divided plane, but actually become internal, like, relationships that are just like you'd make making a friend in your own culture. And I think that that's where study abroad programs are really important, because it breaks down that, those same barriers, you know? Like, there were so many people that would come up to me and, like, look at my Nikes, you know, like, where, you know, where's your chauffeur, like, all, and I'm just like, yo, you know, like, that's not how it is. And, like, then we, the connection after that was just so much more intense, because then they also showed me things that, you know, oh, we don't always do that, or, and that's part of, I think, what's really good about it, and what's really important, and that it's more about how you go into thinking of it, you know, what your mindset is, and your purpose of going.
May I just jump in for a second? Because I think this whole issue of study abroad is one that I personally take really seriously, and it has to do with my own peculiar trajectory before I came to Hampshire. I was brought up in India, and I went to grad school in the US. And I was, to cut a long story short, just horrified at the kinds of programs that were in place. Programs that took people to India for maybe 3 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever. Taught a particular packaging of culture, of South Asian culture. And I think I struggled with this as a graduate student, but at that, in grad school, you don't have much time to do anything really except write your dissertation. When I came to Hampshire, I think the thing that jumped out at me was that, and I'll just say this in part because I really do value being at Hampshire, right? It gave me the kind of freedom, the kind of intellectual freedom that I had never really experienced earlier, perhaps because I was in an institutional, I was operating within an institutional framework as a graduate student. It gave me the kind of freedom to construct a program that really was about the role that images, ideas play in essentially reinforcing notions of power. And I thought of the Jantar program that just sort of, you know, came together just wonderfully as an exercise in critique, right? And the reason I say that is because I think it helped me to resolve some of my own dilemmas about teaching South Asian studies in a predominantly white liberal arts campus in New England with a pretty darn funny accent. The whole thing was just really strange. And I'd struggled with this for a couple of years at Hampshire. When I actually set up the program, it really gave me a chance to, I think, reflect on my own relationship with my culture. It also struck me when I first joined Hampshire that, you know, I'm now 30-something, and I realized that I'd spent about a third of my life in this country. So the whole question of what sense of entitlement do I have towards that culture is one that's been a difficult question for me. What this program helped me to do, and it's the study abroad program, right, was to really address, and I'll say this slowly because it's a mouthful, but it's kind of rehearsed because I do this all the time because I love talking about this program. It forces students to address the specificity of their own learning in the kind of institutional framework that Hampshire is. Not to condemn it, not to necessarily judge it, but to address the specificity of it. Because the kinds of categories that we use when talking about society in general are categories that have a particular history, a particular lineage. And when you put those lenses in a completely different place, and by the way, this doesn't have to be international, this can be a setting outside Hampshire College's campus. When you put those lenses in those contexts, I think to some degree you're forced to confront the history of images and power and analytical frameworks and lenses that we've basically, you know, been exposed to somewhat uncritically, I think, historically. And study abroad in that sense, just to reinforce what you're saying, I think can be an extremely important learning experience. But I think it has to start with this, to my mind at least, a very critical sense of what the program, which it is after all a program, which you're paying for, you know, what its programmatic location is in history. Dan.
That's why I think that your program is, that's really like a special thing, that what's going on. And in order for, I think, anything of this kind to work out in a way where not the same dynamics will be happening over and over, it has to have a certain extremely self-critical lens. And what really concerns me is what is, Greg, actually your comment about like that it's helpful to self-reflect and look at the mistakes we made, that's true, but what's really telling about that comment is that what the mistakes we make really, really destroy other people's lives. And we're going to, a lot of times, third world countries right there, right? We're going to countries that have tons of problems, usually caused by America. We affect things tremendously. And what we really don't have, beyond even we really don't have an understanding of like what we are doing to these places and to the people that we interact with there. And like, that's like one of the biggest problems to me. And that also has a lot to do with the fact that people running the programs are often have no idea what they're talking about with the countries. I mean, that's something that really upsets me. And that was my experience, was that I went to Cuba, and the people that were in charge of the program had such a deep misunderstanding of Cuba that so many people were put in danger. People have gone to jail because of Hampshire. And I was told that by the person who was responsible for that at a cocktail party. And that's the kind of thing that happened. And that makes me really sick. And I think it doesn't have to happen. It doesn't mean that study abroad isn't an inherently evil thing, but it does mean that we, as the community, have a seriously flawed way of going about it and need to really examine it. And I'm glad there's a good model.
I don't know. I actually struggled with the model myself.
That's why it's good.
I guess I wanted to say, I don't know if this is really in Greg's self-defense, because it's not exactly the same thing, but maybe a different way of looking at it. Because I agree with what everyone said about self-reflection before and after. And I think we're sort of like saying, well, you know, like, can you self-reflect before this experience, you know, so that you don't have these impacts where you go? And I still actually have to say don't have a super clear sense of what impacts exactly we're talking about, but I think I have some ideas. And I think that maybe not having done an official study abroad program, but having gone to other places independent of school, that maybe there's something you can do before you go that is much simpler. But I have to agree with what Greg said, that without having these experiences, we wouldn't know to have this conversation in the first place. And that those experiences are what causes us to think about these things, and that's really important. And that sometimes, if we're going to communicate with other cultures, if we're going to communicate with people at all, we're going to make mistakes. And I think what's really important is that we have a sense of humility, I guess, and just a simple understanding of interacting with people in general, regardless of who they are, and that the more complex analysis often does come after those kinds of experiences.
Okay.
I feel like we've been kind of getting at this idea of study abroad within an institutional context, and what conversations do we have, for example, in Hampshire, about study abroad or not have, which I feel is more than the order of the day. But the very concept of study abroad and the fact that we can sit here and talk about the fact that, you know, for me as a student, for example, I'm going to go somewhere and it's not going to be great, not going to be a place that I belong to, that I have any claim to, that has any claim to me. And I'm going to screw up, and I can, you know, I can acknowledge now I'm going to screw up. You know, it's going to be a bummer. Maybe some people get hurt. Maybe not. Like, gee, I hope not. And then I'm going to come back, and I'm going to really learn. And I'm going to feel sorry about that. And I'm going to take that forward and say, okay, next time I won't screw up that way. However, it's coming from, I want to say that I would like us to become conscious of the fact that there's a tremendous amount of privilege, like a tremendous amount of privilege, in being able to sit in a room in Amherst, Massachusetts, and say, I'm 19, I'm 22, whatever, I'm going to go someplace, and I'm going to maybe screw up, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to have learned from it. What are you leaving behind, and what are we talking about in terms of when we, as a Hampshire College space, send people places and bring people back, and that enriches Hampshire College, right? For example, the implications then on the institution are also significant. What does it mean that, as for me, my do I necessarily have the right to go there just because I know that I'm going to come back and learn some stuff and process and move on, and that's great? I don't know. Like, I would like us to talk more about just, you know, what is the very basic role that people play. Can we sit here and say that's all right? Study abroad is this like natural part of education where like we necessarily have that privilege because we're here and because we're accessing higher education. I'm not saying that we necessarily shouldn't be doing that, but I'm saying that the consciousness is critical, and it's not acceptable to say, gee, you know, we're young, whatever. Like, we'll get it together later. Like, that consciousness is critical from the go.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I kind of have a couple thoughts on that. On the one hand, I think it's important to definitely to recognize, you know, privilege and power structure in conversations like these, but also to realize that, like, part of the way cultures progress, whether you want to say they're improving or not, like, is through cross-germination. And there's a kind of it's not just just stepping on each other's toes or caricaturing people. There is interchange that I think is valuable on both sides. And obviously there's a difference between, you know, going on field study to study Aborigines in Australia and studying at a foreign university which invites Americans or anyone else to come study there. I think that, I don't know, I don't think we should get too down on it, basically.
Just to add to what I said, and I think you just said this sort of, but I guess to make sure that we're acknowledging that it's not only negative exchanges that go on, like that all those, you know, like what Kate said about, you know, coming back and yeah, I screwed up, and you know, like everyone screws up, which is definitely true, but also that you screw up a few times and you make a big difference in a positive way a few times as well, and that we're not always the bad guys because we're white and from America, and there are things we do that are negative, but there are also, you know, like that exchange of cultures, that there are also really positive interactions we can have, and that we're all people, which is the point, and on both sides, I guess.
I feel like when Kate was saying, I felt like what you were saying, Kate, really spoke to like the existence of like a really severe imbalance. Because when we use words like exchange, you know, it's like, I think we have to think about like what kind of exchange is going on and on whose terms is that exchange happening. And, you know, so it's like this, like we're only talking about one side. It's like we as privileged Hampshire College students go out, you know, somewhere else. But there's not necessarily like, it's not really like a two-way thing. Like, there's not necessarily access for like those people that we go to work with to come back to Hampshire College and study here. You know, that's not, I mean, even if they weren't going to get, you know, like deported by the INS for being like suspected terrorists, which is happening at, like to foreign students across the country, you know, it's still like financial questions of like, you know, how many people could afford to come spend semester studying in Hampshire. And I think that as part of that question of like self-reflection, I think we really need to be thinking about like not only are we self-reflecting on what we're doing like when we go to, you know, study abroad, but also like are we providing, you know, equal access for people to be coming to study here, like, you know, or are we encouraging, like youth in Zimbabwe to come like run programs at Hampshire College to teach us about, you know, like how to do things.
Let me, because I'm trying to get more people who haven't spoken to join in.
I feel like, I mean, we've talked about, there's people who are saying that, you know, yeah, you go there and the experience is really what makes yourself reflect, and yeah, we'll screw up a couple of times, but that's how we learn. I feel like a lot of people, well, at least from here, I mean, this whole study abroad program, people go, and a lot of people, like, don't realize that they screwed up ever.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, the few who do, I mean, very few people actually do for whatever, like, exceptional circumstances that they go realize that, hey, there is something here that I need to self-reflect on. I feel like that doesn't happen most of the time. And if that can be avoided, why not? Like, if we can really do something about this as an institution, then why do people have a problem with that? Like, you know, it should, this should not be, I don't know, I think that what I'm trying to say is, like, everyone who goes, even as whatever, a white person, whatever, this is not an attack on you personally. These are things that we just have to deal with. Like, we just have to acknowledge that, like, these problems and stereotypes and, like, this whole system exists that often we are all unaware of. And that if we think that we can come back and self-reflect and all those things are just going to come to us, it's not, you know? And, like, I feel like we can really do something. Like, Hampshire as an institution has the power to do something about that. I feel like it should. So.
Yeah.
What are all these things that were screwing up in other countries? That's the thing that I'm interested in this particular argument.
Keep using the word screwing up. What's this, mm-hmm. like, what?
Or the problems that American students are creating in other countries.
Ali, I want to get back.
I think this very neatly comes back to cultural appropriation as well. Because you go there, like, I don't know, there's, and like, you come back, and I feel like, you know, like, initially bringing back to, like, what we were talking about initially, like, how culture is fluid and stuff, but I feel like when, you know, parts of, like, you go to another country, you see certain cultures, and you know that certain things exist in this country which are supposedly representative of that culture, the power dynamic is such that it changes that definition in a way that is harmful to other people. Like, I feel like changing definitions of culture, there's nothing wrong with it, but when it's harmful to other people, there is something wrong with it. So I feel like when this whole thing contributes to that, people come back thinking it's okay to, you know, have stuff up in that room because that's just because you support it or whatever, but that's not how the people from that particular area, or all of them, or some of them, see it, you know, so.
I just want to bring it back to someone asked the question originally earlier, what is culture? And we're talking about culture being fluid, and really to me, culture is something that I feel in my blood. It isn't something that I question. It's something that I know keeps me rooted. It's something that gives me a sense of peace at the end of the day. It's who I am. And to know that, I think it gets dangerous when we're talking about the school store. I see the school store. I see hair politics with the dreadlocks. I see upper class students dressing as though they're low income, and I also see study abroad as all highly, highly connected in the way that we can buy into and we can actually purchase what we see as culture, and a culture that is not already ours. And I think that the danger in doing study abroad programs and the danger in allowing or having objects available in the school store to purchase is that it gives people sort of an idea that once they're in ownership of that, or once that they're present in that culture, once that they've traveled to Mexico, they now know what Mexico is, they now know what it's like to feel Mexican, and they can come back here with this sort of deeper understanding, self-reflected, you know, more culturally aware and more worldly, liberal idea of what it means to exist as a human and a non-racialized person. And I think that that's really dangerous because the aftermath of that for students of color who do attend this school, and in my personal experience, have not been able, because of a lot of financial situations, to actually travel on those programs, and that it is predominantly white upper-class students who are able to take that time off from school, to take that time off from financial aid, or to have family support to do those trips. It creates a situation when those students come back, or when they come back and they have bought something at the school store to say, oh, can you tell me about, like what Rios was saying, can you tell me about Chiapas? Can you tell me about what this mariachi is? Can you tell me about what this Indian god is? You know, can you tell me about that? Because now I own it, now I traveled there, now I understand it, and I need your help to help me understand it more. And I think that what I see as the serious danger in this is that we create power dynamics between students on a very interpersonal level that is never, I've rarely seen acknowledged at the school, that that happens within classrooms, between professors and students, and between students and students when they're living together. And yes, it happens no matter where you're living, but Hampshire College is responsible for creating a very specific type of cultural appropriation that is allowed. And I think that that's what I see as sort of the aftermath or you know, what are all these negative things that we're creating? Well, I think everyone's going to have a different experience about what they see as that negative aftermath. I don't think we can say, when you go to this country, this is the negative aftermath. I think that it's a lot of smaller situations, and I think that that's what's fueled, for me, the need to see this conversation. That isn't one thing. It's a lot of smaller things that have built up, I know, in my mind, as a fourth year here. You know, I'm about to leave, and I've never seen this kind of a conversation really openly talked about. I've tried to get hair politics part of this school for a while now, and there's a lot of reluctance to deal with that. So I just, you know, I think that that's what I'd like to say being here, but that I think having a conversation about what the negative aftermath is a whole other conversation. It's very deep. It's very complicated. It's also very different for each person involved. Mm-hmm.
Just a quick question. I'm not familiar with the term. What do you mean when you say hair politics? I'm not sure. I can make a guess, but I'm not sure.
I'm only going to speak for myself. For me, hair politics has to do with culture appropriating different politics around hair, and that there is a trend among certain liberal, white, non-conservative students to lock your hair, and that I'm from a very predominantly black community, and it's highly offensive, and I don't feel comfortable allowing or bringing my black friends to campus, knowing that there's going to be an exposure to a very large community of white people with fake locks, and that is offensive to certain black people, to certain people who live an Afrocentric lifestyle, and that isn't a conversation that usually can be had. That it's not about saying you can't have that hair, but it's about saying, do you understand why you are, choosing to represent yourself in that way, and do you understand the history behind even the word dreadlock, and who created that word, and why it was created? So that's sort of my hair politics thing.
Yeah.
I guess another thing that I think of, the question of what is growing up, is just academia in general. I think that if you're at a college like Hampshire College, and you will be going further into the world of academia, and you have these ideas from study abroad, and you write about that, and you do future work, that and you're the one that's teaching, more people who will soon be in power. I just think that it's a cycle. I also think that study abroad is interesting for me personally, because at this point in my life, I'm interested in studying my roots. And I question people who are studying other people's roots, and I kind of want to know why they aren't questioning their own roots, so they can contextualize themselves in the world before they go out and study different.
Yep.
I'm kind of interested about how people address people who are studying abroad within Hampshire, and not necessarily technically from abroad, but I think one thing that we're not really acknowledging is the fact that you don't have to go to another country to have another culture. And I would essentially consider that I've been on study abroad for 4 years. I came here from the streets, and this place is not the streets. But we don't talk about that. And we're starting with this dialogue saying, yeah, so Hampshire is this rich, white, affluent place, but no one's talking about where I'm from. And when I do see people engaging with it, they're engaging it with Holyoke and Springfield, and they're going down there to help. And then they come back here, and it's very protected in that way. But the problem is that there's no one here to have a voice. I think what we do in academia is we put a lot of, we listen to professors, right, because they're supposed to know, because they have all this training. And basically what that means to me is they have this language. They've been trained in a certain, keywords and everything. But we put people that have these keywords up on pedestals. So all of a sudden you have a hierarchy built on language, and the people at the top are the ones who have been taught to be articulate and have the credentials and all of this stuff. And when you're talking about credentials and all that, people that are on the streets are not going to have credentials, because no one's asking them what their resume about, how many knife fights they've been in, or, even how many shelters they've been in, any of that kind of stuff. So in order to have a safe place for people people that are low income, for people who are trans, for people who are queer, people of color, people from other countries, you know, people with single parent families, all of this stuff. You have to have it represented in the professorship and in the staff here. And we don't have that. And so I challenge you to say, like, if you want me to come and study abroad here, then you should maybe, like, implement a little program for me, too, where I can talk to other people who are in poverty and who have to work full-time while they're here. You should have trans professors, because nobody knows what's going on this campus, and, you know, we're, like, basically starving, and we're freezing, and we're hungry, and we can't do our work because we can't get hired at places. But we're not acknowledging that we don't even have an infrastructure for our own students that isn't just for white, affluent America.
Do you want me to respond to that?
I'm just looking at you because you're looking at me.
You made so many different points. Let me just try to respond to one. You don't have to go abroad to engage in or see or confront the kind of cultural conflicts, differences, absences that you've outlined. I would totally agree with that. As an institution, can we replicate the full scope of society? No. Is your challenge that we provide a way for that conversation to take place appropriately? Yes. And we will keep trying to provide it. We do it, we try to provide it, and we don't provide enough of it, but we do try to provide it. Whether it be through community, community partnership program and their attempt to bring people on campus, or if you're dealing with in terms of the international side, in almost all of the programs that we have abroad, we do bring people from those programs to this campus. From Cuba, from the Tibetan community, from China, Berlin, we do not regularly in the same way. We don't recreate as fully as you're challenging us to do. The fact that you're challenging us to do it, I think, is totally appropriate. To recreate that, I mean, to create that conversation so it's circular and not just in one direction.
I think the next step just needs to be the fact that I hear that you're saying that, but what I hear from friends of mine who are people of color is that you've tried to do it, but it's really miserably failed. And that, I mean, that's where I think that we should take this conversation right now, because if you're an institution, you're saying, we're dealing with issues of racism, and we're dealing with all these issues, but the people who you're supposed to be supporting and teaching are saying you're failing, then you're really failing. And that needs to be listened to and discussed.
Yep.
You know, and I mean, basically, like, we're not even on to transgender issues. And that's because we're not ready, because we haven't even dealt with race. You know, and I mean, it seemed like Hampshire as an institution only has the capability to deal with one issue at a time. That's pretty sad, but we haven't even made enough headway in like one issue to be able to talk about being poor here.
Yep.
I just, this doesn't directly, I mean, I guess it has to do with a lot. I just wanted to say that I think it's important to keep in mind that the same way that we're talking about like study abroad or appropriate, like, yeah, study abroad programs and appropriation being dangerous in the way that we assume that we understand cultures based on specific icons or specific things that we stamp as being, you know, like what this culture is. We're also doing that, like, I'm just saying us in this room or people having this conversation, the same way when we look at a white person with dreadlocks and assume that they don't understand what it means to have dreadlocks, or assume that, you know, like, we're doing the exact same thing. And I'm finding, I just think it's important to to keep that in mind, that there's a lot of hypocrisy in the way that we are going about this, I guess, because because there, yeah, you just can't, it's hard to, you know, you don't know what's going on in people's heads, and you don't know that that white person that's dressing poor isn't actually poor, or that, that, you know what I mean? Like, and it's not just white, it's like all of everybody, and I just think that that's an important thing to keep in mind when we're talking about this, because we don't know what goes on in people's lives unless you talk to them about it.
I mean, I guess part of that is that I feel like we're not supposed to talk to people about it, and like that isn't part of the program, that isn't part of the idea. And that, for example, like, speaking of, like, study abroad experiences, people coming to Hampshire in terms of study abroad or something, I'm not sure I'd necessarily frame it as such, but I know there are a lot of staff members who are immigrants to this country who work for Hampshire College. Yet their experience is very different than my experience when I go abroad. Their ability to be deported, their ability to, or inability to make any real wages, their ability to actually experience another culture, except in maybe the ways in which that it doesn't accept them, is very different in all manner than anything that I can, than any study abroad experience I would have going to any country. And for me to kind of say that it's, that Hampshire as an institution is somehow not responsible to those people who are part of the institution in terms of being staff, but is only responsible to the students and needs to provide, and that needs to provide these study abroad experiences without opening up a dialogue with the staff, for example. Like the fact that, you know, instead of saying, okay, let's go to, you know, Mexico or Tibet or whatever, like, how about we talk to some of the people who, you know, we're employing to pick up our shit and, like, see what they think about where they're coming from or whatever else. And the fact that there's no mechanisms for that to happen, like, before you go abroad, like, let's see how people's experiences coming to this country, like, what is that like for people? Like, how can we compare those experiences? What are those, is Hampshire as an institution, how is it playing off those experiences when those are two parts of Hampshire Institution? One is sending these people, on these, like sending white students like myself on like these kind of fun, exciting learning experiences, and another part is denying people that same opportunity when they get to a fun, exciting experience in America or whatever else. I think those things are related, and I think it's important that we recognize that they're related, and it's important that we provide spaces on campus for people to discuss that type of stuff, like other people were saying in terms of students coming here and faculty.
Just to throw in another way, in more concrete way that I've seen that going abroad and cultural appropriation can affect things is that it's more economic effect of the sort of the power that a white person, and the image of power and the actual power of a white person brings with money behind them to another culture that often results in what they call staged authenticity, sort of you see selling of specific aspects of the culture that economically is proven that, you know, Americans like to have in their houses. And that then becomes the way in which these people represent their culture. And we don't give people the freedom because of this power we have of this image to actually practice their own culture, or to allow their culture to develop. We sort of often freeze this culture in time and say, oh, this you know, particularly ethnic statue is how I conceive of this culture. And then you go there and, you know, half the people in that culture are making these ethnic statues, which they haven't used in, you know, 700 years to sell to white people. That's more, one more.
Do me a favor, drag that out a little bit. I got what you said. What's the most important implication of that situation?
That we, they said, by the power of the, I mean, I don't know, there's a lot of different ways. One way could be that the power of the dollar affects the representation, people representing their own cultures, right? And the problem with that is then we sort of imagine that this is an increased authenticity. You know, we're not just getting it from the bookstore. We're getting it from the real people. You know, when in fact this is not something that is at all authentic to their experience. It's not something that has been authentic to their experience, maybe ever. But our conceptions through our media and through our our objects is affecting that.
Now, implicit in what you just said is the idea that there is some sort of real, authentic, cultural locus that was there, sort of existing in its purity, until a tourist came along and said, "Oh, I want to buy that object and a system of economic relation to itself." I wonder if there are any places where you can find some sort of culture that has existed in some kind of pure, unchanging, non-interacting condition. I guess it takes me back to what Michelle said earlier about the fluidity of culture. It seems to me that there's always borrowing going on, and that a lot of that borrowing happens in the context of economically defined relationships. And in that sense, the people who have the dollars or whatever currency it happens to be at the time to purchase things help condition what it is that people produce for sale.
I guess part of that problem is sort of one of the things we've exported is commodity culture, right? And so like we're not just asking them, you know, it's not that they weren't authentic before. It's not that they were authentic before, but they didn't care. They were doing their own shit, you know. And we come along and say, no, do our shit, do what we want. Do what we think is authentic, and we're going to create a structure whereby you rely on our money. And then we're going to use our money to tell you what to sell it. And you could argue for that sort of a neutral. Oh no, we're all part of this economic and cultural exchange. But I think the power is there.
I don't actually think. I mean, he was definitely saying that there is an economic issue at the center of it. And I keep thinking throughout this conversation. There's a piece that, forgive me, that I would ask you to look up and read. I think it addresses a lot of these issues about cultural visibility and invisibility and questions of economic power. It's by Renato Rosaldo, and it's the chapter called Border Crossings in his book called Culture and Truth. And he presents an argument where he talks about anthropologists as, you know, yes, this is a discipline of colonialism, but there is a tremendous amount of critique which occurs within the discipline of anthropology today since the 1980s, or what I'd say about the 1980s. And Renato Rosaldo says when he said he was going to go study in the Philippines, he was told, you know, what do you do that for? Those people don't have culture anymore. And so he starts to examine how is it that we assume some people have culture and some people don't have culture. And so he comes to this equation. And here I'm not talking about the kind of culture that if I'm going to talk about culture in an anthropological sense, I would want to stick with practices. Practices, some inherited, some improvised in the moment, okay, according to traditions, according to moments, interactions, etc., rather than things, okay? But in the sense that those people over there have culture and we don't, gets defined in terms of who has economic power and who doesn't. And so that cultural visibility is connected to a position of power. I mean, excuse me, to inequality, okay? And the person who supposedly has no culture is usually in a position of economic power. And he discusses that as an anthropologist facing this question. And he comes to the end of it, and he's studying borders, you know, and he's looking at, Chicano artists on the border. So it's to me, it's an interesting piece that takes apart these issues in a way that anthropologists have been dealing with, and he's very critical of the history of the discipline as well. And this sort of living in area is exactly what a lot of people are. It's the same kind of experience that you would have in an education abroad program of actually living in situ, and that's sort of at the center of the anthropological project is that living in situ. But this piece gets into all of those kinds of issues and how he comes to terms with that at the end. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. I think like when you bring up that question of economic power, I feel like that's like a really important component that we need to address. I feel like that's like one of the big things in these studies of abroad programs, like with tourism, like it is about power. And it's not only like are we as like privileged white students the ones going on a study abroad program, but also like you know, have to go into the tourism industry to, you know, sort of like have this like false authenticity because like no other jobs exist in the Hawaiian economy because the entire like place is owned by U.S. corporations for the purpose of making money off of like tourism. So it's like it's like the whole situation is conditioned by that. So I think when we engage in this thing, we need to think about that. And when we go to another place, we need to think like rather than just accepting at face value and accepting how people are interacting with us at face value, think of like how are these economic structures conditioned to this, and like how can we challenge that in the way that we interact with the space? How can we think of ways of like engaging in you know, whatever like study programs or setting up study programs that challenge who like controls the like economic realities that like control people's lives, and like whether we're perpetuating that control by U.S. corporations of other people's lives, or whether we're helping to like work against that so that people might be able to, you know, engage in more of a like an equal exchange where it's not like totally controlled by the economic.
I want to respond to the your comment about like the whether or not there's authenticity in culture, and I think it the reason that this conversation is exciting is because it brings up those questions. And there's also a lot of times when I've had this conversation when it'll be stopped by people saying, well, it's a really slippery slope, because if you say that they have a culture and they don't, then who has a culture, who has a culture? It kind of like, and that, and then try to sort of cancel out the argument. And that's what happens a lot of the time, is that that ends up, it's hard to go past that. And I think that like there comes a point where we need to talk about that and deal with it and also move past it, because what that can often erase, like it's really easy to be like, well, culture exists, it's a construction, but you know, like we're all sort of one at the same time. But like from this side of the computer screen and this side of the camera and this side of everything, but what we erase when we do that is power. And power is what the most intense thing that is like really going on in so many of these situations. And like I guess like what happens, what Drew was talking about to me, like makes me think of like, yeah, and okay, my example is Cuba because that's where I've been and that's where I've associated with through my family. It's like in Cuba, you can buy like little Che Guevara heads and little cigars and all these things, right? Right. And what's authentic? I don't know what's authentic. I know that 12-year-old Cuban women sell their body to Americans, and that we participate in that when we go to Cuba and throw our dollars around, and even when we don't sleep with them, like that. And there comes a time when I'm ready to say, okay, I don't want to talk about whether or not what's authentic anymore. I just want to fight that, and I just want to say I don't want to be a part of that, and I'm sick of that. And academia aside, fuck academia. That's a big problem in the world, and we all take part in it. And I need to say that we need to stop it. And we can get so bogged down by these like huge texts and these huge words and these meanings and definitions, and we do need to think about them, but we also need to know when to fuck them off the table and say, let's do this and let's do something important and move on.
Yeah.
I was just gonna say, there's been, I mean, we're talking a lot about like the power of a white person in these places, but I think also some credit, and maybe I'm not assuming, I'm not putting people in, but it's just important to raise that like these places aren't passive to like white culture and money and capitalism also, and that I think that in being like almost overcritical, in some ways you can be almost racist in a lot of ways, because you're simplifying a place and being like, well, you know, because we came in here as tourists and because we came in here with business, we're eliminating something, and you know, we have this power, and like in a way of acknowledging that power, we're asserting it in some way. And so I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, like actually like the conversation about fluidity of culture actually kind of got me thinking, and it's like, you know, actually culture is fairly fluid, but what's really not fluid is power. And like we've been bringing this up like consistently, like these notions of power and dominance and privilege, like, you know, what is that? And I feel that our definition of cultural appropriation or appropriating culture may be a very vague definition, but what is very clear cut is privilege. Like, and I think that when we begin to discuss ways of addressing study abroad programs or the bookstore, I think that it's our responsibility through these discussions to kind of contextualize this by looking at, okay, like, let's complicate this. Why does this exist? How does this happen? And how is it, how does privilege actually, I think, blind us. I mean, like, for me, as a male, like, I mean, how many other males think about, like, walking around on Saturday night? How many of us that identify as a specific gender or, like, the gender that we were supposedly born into think about going into a bathroom, you know? Like, there are so many different layers that, like, I think privilege blinds us. How can we create a dialogue that starts to look at how do we, like, remove that blindfold and start looking at, like, a lot of these issues appropriately? Because I think that's how it perpetuates, really.
Let me, I'll take one more comment and then just to urge anyone who hasn't spoken to speak, and also to